Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial.
The euro dives on Trichet's comments. Silver plunges and commodities along with it. Earnings are coming out pretty strong. And we have Kevin Hoffman here as a guest to talk about all things about the markets. Hey, just want to let you know out there, this is Andrew Horowitz, by the way. You're listening to episode number 211 on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And we have some great guests lined up. We have Andrew Ross Sorkin from the New York Times coming up in the next couple of weeks. We have John Perkins, who is that wonderful writer about all things black ops, I guess we could say. And we have Jack Schwager scheduled, who is the author of that famous series, The Market Wizard. So we have lots to look forward to, even if the markets don't cooperate for the short term, because we've seen some very, very changing environment over the last week or so. And a lot of that has to do with what we talked about over the last couple of months, is this whole trade that's related to the dollar and how that's going to play out over time. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Kevin and I did some work, Kevin Hoffman, who works with me here at Horowitz & Company. We did some work trying to put together a bit of an overview of some of the things that you really need to be paying attention to now, and then how maybe to look at them and what to do with them. And, you know, because there is, like I said, a lot of areas that are pressing on the markets, whether it's the economic numbers, whether it's inflation, whether it's the you know, the political environment that we see, whether we see another earthquake again like we did last week in Japan, a 6.1 over Honshu, or you just look at the fact that maybe some things are slowing down around the world and coming to maybe still a growth phase, but you know, a little bit more normalization. So all of this is going to be kind of the things that we're going to be dealing with, and I think that it's going to probably create some opportunities, but maybe some volatility as well. Anyway, so I thought we'd get right to it. Kevin, how are you, buddy?
Doing great. How are you doing?
It's been a while. It's not too long. I think a couple months, right?
Yeah, a couple months here and there.
So lots going on over here at Horowitz Company. I know you know all about that, and we're glad we could take some time and talk about some of the things that we wanted to go over. So I thought what we would do is, I think it's really pertinent. One of the things that you've been talking about lately is this whole idea of a sector rotation.
Right, right.
So kind of fill us in. What's happening? And first of all, I'd probably be remiss to, you know, why don't you explain what sector rotation is and why that occurs?
Sure. Yeah, that's sector rotation is probably one of the biggest things you can take a look at for when a market is going to turn or when it's beginning to turn. Typically, you know, something like economics or, you know, watching NFP data or watching initial claims and other economic data is more, I guess, past looking. And, you know, you really can't really get a gauge on what the market's going to do except for maybe that one day move. Mm-hmm. However, with the sector rotation, you can kind of see what areas are moving in a positive direction and what areas are moving into a negative direction. Right now, typically, we're seeing some of the safer areas of the market, such as utilities, healthcare, telecoms, and some of the consumer staples, showing a lot more strength in the market compared to some of the higher, what they would call maybe a higher beta.
The risk trades.
Yeah, the risk trade,
right,
which would be,
right,
you know, your small caps or more specifically sector-wise, some of the energy companies, technology companies, and some of the more, you know, riskier asset classes. that you would typically see.
But let me ask you something. Let me just interrupt. The whole idea of sector rotation and what's happening, it's not a strategy necessarily, but it's just a observation. So over the last, I think over 12 weeks or so, we've been looking at how there's been a clear movement from risk trade assets to more of the staples and the healthcare, like you mentioned. So is that necessarily a negative thing, or is it possible that some of those ran up for so long that they're just maybe a mutual fund or a hedge fund or investors are rotating into things that haven't risen and kind of taking their profits and reinvesting in the lower?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, you're definitely having some possible reallocation. There's two possible scenarios really that come offhand quickly is that, you know, you have what Andrew was talking about is a rebalancing type situation where you have technology stocks and energy stocks that have run up so incredibly well over the past, oh gosh, maybe 6 months or so. And then you have these utilities and healthcare companies that have kind of not necessarily done poorly, but they've definitely lagged when compared to the technology.
So
and
on,
energy
a, on a relative basis.
Yeah, on a relative basis.
Right.
So, but the other solution is that, you know, people are definitely trying to take down some of their risk. And
now, why is that? So I mean, do you think that has to do with, first of all, last week we saw an incredible situation. We talked about this on the podcast and how that the silver that went parabolic is probably not going to end well. And I got to tell you, folks, I mean, it ended a lot worse than I anticipated, a lot worse. There was no bounce there. I mean, you know, a little bit. But really, nothing to speak of. And when the selling started, it cascaded. I think that the CME, by the way, with their latest margin requirements, was a little bit too aggressive. I mean, we had four raises in a week. Four.
Yep.
You got to wonder what changed one day to the next to increase it another time. And then the final one that they did was two at once that they whacked you with. One was going to take effect on May 5th and one on May 9th. Now, I thought that was extremely aggressive. And I think it was bordering on the reckless.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you that it was a rather harsh move. I think, you know, you may have had some government officials maybe coming down and saying, hey, you know what, we've seen this kind of situation happen in the past with oil where we get too many speculators involved in the market. And once you get these speculators in the market, you know, it's kind of like it's kind of like there's just too much money flowing in and too much hype, and the CME just doesn't want to have a situation where people are too leveraged and then at some point in time they lose all their money, and then they have these margin calls. And then once you have these margin calls, you know, you have some counterparty risk. And counterparty risk is basically a risk that the person that you're trading with is going to default on you. And once that happens, then the CME's got to come in and basically back the person that's defaulted.
Right.
So that's one of the biggest problems that probably the CME was trying to strangle. But, you know, then again, what they did was you know, very rampant and very harsh.
Right. You said it was harsh. I mean, it killed the goose, basically. I mean, the CME basically came in and, you know, raised the rate of requirement of margin four times in the span of a week. And I don't know what the point was. So anyway, the point is that, you know, whether you want to look at this as a, you know, some of the people that are thinking, you know, that, oh, this is a behind the scenes deal so that like a Soros and all those guys can get like all this cheap silver or, you know, but I think also it spilled over into the oil market where you see, so oil sell off by like 9%. We're talking about a euro that dropped, 2%.
Right.
2%.
Yep.
And the wheels came off the whole entire complex.
Yeah, I think that was one of the big things that started the oil dip down today was that the ECB didn't raise their rates. I mean, Trichet came out and the BOE, the Bank of England, also came out and said, hey, we're not going to raise any rates. I'm not sure why, but, you know, maybe it's because of the inflation or whatever, but...
I'll give you a reason. Ready? Their economies suck.
That's true.
Except for Germany, which, by the way, is having its own little problems in terms of sentiment in the latest surveys. And on top of that, they're seeing actually slow down in industrial production. But I have been very, I don't even know what to say, dumbfounded how the ECB could be raising rates in an environment where half of the countries that participate are about to default.
Well, I think the point here is that
they're trying to control inflation and or the inflation that, you know, is subsequently either out there or not out there. Bernanke says it's not out there. The European Union seems to think that it's there. They want to control it. They want to make sure it's intact. So
let me share this with you. How about this thought? Ready? The more the Europeans tighten, the higher the euro goes against the dollar. Because when you tighten, it usually pushes the value of your dollar, of your currency up. And if we're talking about the euro dollar, that means it would push on the dollar down.
Right.
Pushing on the dollar down actually will create additional inflation because as you have commodities that are priced in dollars, it actually raises the price of everybody.
Yep, that's very possible.
Therefore, coming full circle, if you raise interest rates there to combat inflation, you're creating more inflation.
That's true.
That is
very, very possible.
So I never understood why they're going to raise rates. It was the stupidest thing I ever heard of. And I can't believe that people were really betting. I don't even know what they were betting on. Were they betting? They were betting at such a level of the on the dollar, or was it more so that they were betting on the euro? That's probably what it was, a big bets on the euro.
Right.
And it just collapsed, and it just took. And then on top of the fact that there was this negative sentiment on silver for a couple of days and just killed it all.
Yep, exactly.
I don't know. Listen, I think we talked about that. I think we talked about last week that I recommended that you get short silver, and I got a couple of emails thanking me actually for that. That was really nice. You're welcome. We had some silver. We went in and out of the short position, and for our clients, and it was profitable. And then we entered a little bit too early on the long side. It did look like it was way overdone. I think what happened here, this happens, and we've seen this before, is you get a panic cascade. And what happens is that the selling begets more selling, then the margins come in, which begets more selling, and then when you get a double whammy, who knows? We may find out after hours, next week sometime, there was something else going on. Who knows?
Yep, that's very possible.
But in the end of the day, you know, you look at this whole scenario as, I think, a little bit beneficial. You know, you saw some of the companies, for example, the shoe companies.
Right.
All right, everybody, I have a confession. You're not going to believe this. I did something I've never thought I'd ever do. Never thought you would ever thought I would do. If you've been with me long enough, you know what I'm talking about. Well, you'll understand. We actually bought a company that I had one of those mental breakdowns about. That how it was so overvalued. How could you do it? Crocs. Yes, we bought Crocs. Long, not short. Why? It's the first time ever it made it into anything that resembles a quality fundamental screen. And its technicals were looking great. And the good news is, last week was shoe week, it seemed.
That's right.
Deckers and Crocs, we should look at, you know, Steve Madden. I mean, they were looking pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, Crocs is really, you know, it seems to me, after that fall, that huge fall from grace, they've really, you know, gotten down to the nitty-gritty. They got lean, they got mean, you know, they're ready to start doing some more business. And if they could start marketing and they could start, you know, pushing their product, I mean, the product is great.
I have a pair.
Yeah, I do.
I swore I'd never have a pair, by the way. And I bought one like maybe 6 months ago. And everybody that knows me was, you're wearing Crocs. I'm like, yeah. And at the time I said, maybe I should buy the stock. I should look at that.
That might have been the capitulation.
That was for everybody, the world. They realized it was totally done.
Yeah.
But we see this a lot, you know, when you have companies that maybe did fall out of grace, people don't want to look at again, and then, you know, they change the management, they change the structure, or they just enhance, or they, you know, they're not always dead forever.
Right.
You know, and just look what happened with Intel last week. I mean, Intel really, you know, now they're looking to compete with ARM on going after Apple products and all that. You know, I want to kind of go over a couple different things. You know, some things that you talked about with me, and, you know, the earnings story is still kind of strong. You know, it looks relatively good. But you know, there's some weird things happening in the market, particularly in the IPO market. There was a company called Renren.
Yes, yes.
Which is the yes.
Did you just say Renren?
Renren.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So did you notice that there were some weird things that happened before the IPO came out last week, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, Renren's had some trouble here. They went into the IPO week. And they had a person on their audit committee who was also a part of a company called Longtop Financial. Longtop Financial is a company in China that does financial business or software services and whatnot for Chinese companies. And unfortunately, you know, Longtop Financial has been plagued with this kind of rumor of accounting issues and accountability issues. that Renren just, you know, just did not need a part of. And the CFO was the head of their audit committee. So imagine that. You have a guy that is supposed to keep accounting problems to a minimum, and he's on your audit committee. You know, that just doesn't seem like a good way to do it. So in essence, the guy stepped down. And,
yeah, we're not creating a major problem for all the other Chinese internet companies. You know, you look at CNN, so who are NetEase and blah, 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 Kuki and Kaki, blah, 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 all those,
you know, it kind of waterfalled into all the different companies, the Baidus, the Sohus, you know, the whole business. So, but you know what? Despite that, Renren, you know, they priced at the absolute high of what their IPO was.
Well, we knew they would. I mean, anybody that says they're the Facebook of, like Baidu is the Google of China.
That's
Renren
right.
is the Facebook. Facebook? Good, we're in there.
That's right, exactly. You say Facebook about anything. That's why Crocs, maybe Crocs is on Facebook
they
now.
They are.
Oh, are they?
Oh, yeah. I'm part of the fan page. No, I'm kidding. The interesting thing about the Renren situation, two things. First of all, the valuation is two times Facebook.
Right.
Which is, Facebook's valuation is a gazillion times anything normal.
Right.
So that's the first issue that you got to kind of point out. The second thing to point out, in full disclosure, I think there's someone that I know well that owns some Renren.
Yes.
Who's that?
I own some Renren.
You
myself,
own some Renren.
Yes.
Okay. So.
Yeah, very, very speculative, though. You know, it's one of those positions that I want to take a look at. And the only way for me to take a look at it is to hold a position. Sometimes that's the best way to do it, you know, and will it work out? I have no idea.
Well, the opportunity is clearly there, and the appetite is there for that kind of stock. But let's talk about the other things that I just want to mention something. What really, I think, set things off was that in the prospectus for the IPO, there was some things like there's a discussion about that they don't know about generally accepted accounting principles, or they don't keep up with it, and that they are not familiar with the treasury market and the process of many of the U.S. market issues. There was also some discussion about some of the audited results. There was also a discussion, I think, of that they didn't really know how many subscribers they had. I think that would probably be good.
Yeah, that was a big issue because they were looking for subscriber growth. And in the original prospectus, I might have mixed this up, but I think at some point they wanted to see what the growth was, and they were looking at it sequentially.
They were looking at the heights.
Rather than quarter over quarter. So it's very difficult to try and compare fundamentals that, you know, we have and we hold in the U.S. as, you know, generally accepted practices versus some Chinese company that we have absolutely no clue what their fundamentals are.
Yeah, I hear you. But again, it's created a lot of excitement, the whole issue of this Facebook. And that's actually one of the stocks that we have that we've gone in and out of, and who knows where it's going to end up. But it's a company that also is an offshoot of something exciting. In other words, oftentimes you'll see an effect that one stock will have on another, or one idea will have on another. So you have the Renren, which is the Facebook of China, et cetera. They have to prove themselves out eventually. But one of the things that's going to be coming out eventually, besides the Facebook IPO, is Zynga. Zynga.
Oh, is it Zynga? Zynga? I don't even know.
Eventually, Farmville and Mafia Wars and Words for Friends and all. Great model, unbelievable company. People love it, and the concept they love. The reality is, though, there's not many companies out there right now that are publicly traded on the U.S. exchanges that have some liquidity that actually do gaming. Now, I'll tell you that I think it was the Gartner Group came out a couple of days ago with some enormous number about the profit potential for Apple and other companies to make from games on tablet and communication devices. So Glu Mobile is the name of this. They came out with earnings, actually. They beat by 5 cents, which was still a net loss. They had revenue. They do a lot of ad revenue type of product and add-ons, and they build for other providers, which is really cool. And their stuff is gorgeous. Isn't it gorgeous?
Oh, it's amazing.
What's the new game? What game do you have there? The new one you have?
Oh, I got a couple different ones. I mean, they do Paperboy. They do the World Series of Poker.
There's a new one. There's it's like a war thing, or wartime, or combat, or.
You know, they have so many games. It's unbelievable.
They're beautiful, though.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just elegant.
And the profit potential for these companies is just absolutely amazing, because you know what? If you have an application system that a three-year-old can go on and buy a game with your credit card number already stored on there.
That's the three-year-old with your credit card.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, it's unbelievable. You go on there, you tap it, and it's done.
And by the way, if you think that's objectionable, that a three-year-old or a five-year-old will have your credit card information and utilize that, that's not a big deal. Trust me. When they turn about 15, 16, it's not that you don't want them using it, but the numbers The quantity, the amount is objectionable. That's what they put on the credit card.
That's right.
So, you know, my wife says that kids have to have a credit card. Why? Well, you know, they can be in an emergency. Like, what kind of emergency was they had to buy True Religion jeans? I mean, I don't understand the emergency. What is that? What is that? What emergency? They had to take two of their friends out to the Italian restaurant. I don't understand. You know, and then she says, don't worry, I'll make them pay for it.
You must be the best dad.
Oh, I am. I am. Because I just say, whatever. I just, you know, trust me. I, you know, it's just, you just let it go. And then the other thing is that, you know, when you look at the IPO market right now, it's not really robust. I mean, it's been okay, but it's not robust.
No, I mean, it's been kind of a trickle here and there. I mean, the other one you had this week was Boingo.
Oh, and, well, how stupid is that?
I mean, to each their own, but you know what? It's something that's available for consumers, and you know that you're kind of at you're kind of trapped right now. I mean, you still have the availability of smartphones to use their wireless services. Before we get into too much detail, many of you may not know what Boingo is, but Boingo is basically a wireless hotspot in most of the airports, and I'm not sure if they do any retail outlets or not. But
they're all over the place. They're in hotels sometimes. They're just around,
right? But
I think they're on some of the planes too that use the Boingos.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, this is going to be this could be a dying.
I don't get it.
Practice.
I don't get it. Why would you, if you have a 3G, 4G, and who knows what G or whatever device, whether it's a tablet or it's a phone or whether it's a computer that you plug in a little, an internet device, and you get on a plane that may have internet, why do you need to do this anymore?
Well, I mean, I think that's the point exactly. Is that you know. Most companies or corporations that are sending their business clientele that need to use the internet quite often are, you know, given those AT&T wireless cards, the air cards, whatever they are, right. You know, from Verizon or Sprint. And
this is going to go the way of the payphone. Remember those days?
Oh yeah, the payphone. Right, right.
Remember that? You remember that, right?
No, I don't.
You don't really?
No. I'm. Yeah.
Really? Are you kidding?
No.
Oh my God. Let's. All right. Thanks, Kevin. Nice talking to you. Payphone. Used to before the days when there were car phones, cell phones, bricks, whatever you used to call those things, right? We would actually, horrifying as this may seem, we'd actually spend time in a car without the ability to talk to anybody if there was nobody in the car with you or the outside world. Or even worse, if you got stuck on the side of the road, you stand there like an idiot trying to wave down somebody. Okay? Because you wouldn't just call somebody and ask for a pickup. You know, you hope that a tow truck would pass by. So what you would do is you would kind of mentally know where all the payphones were. With these, it was standalone payphones, and you had to take a quarter or a dime, whatever it was. And that's the only way you can make phone calls. You'd go to the corner and you make a. I'm going downstairs. I'm going outside. I'm going to make a call. And you go to the payphone on the corner.
Right. Yeah.
And people were always. You'd always walk by one in Manhattan, especially, and put your finger in, see if anybody dropped a quarter in there. They left a quarter in there.
Yep.
As a kid, but no, you know, it's a whole different world. And I think that you know, when you see this kind of technology, which is an interesting idea, I don't understand though, why anybody would pay extra for this. You know, here and there, I get it. I've done it. But with the current technology we have out there, it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only way that they're really going to corner this market is if they can do some kind of subscription where it's some kind of a WiMAX product, where
right.
they can pull in and make it your home wireless, you know, wherever you go wireless, or your car wireless, or
yeah,
whatever.
But they'd have to put it all over the country. That's impossible.
I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying that may be the only way that they can do this, is to pair up with an AT&T or pair up with a Verizon or something like that. But, you know, it's definitely an old thing, but... You know, you still don't have the ability to tether your iPhone. Or no, do you?
Yeah, you do now. You just pay $20 a month.
Yeah, right. You pay a little extra. And that's the thing. So, you know, Boingo, it may be a tough investment, especially considering, you know, it priced higher in its range on the IPO. They were looking for somewhere between $12 and $14, but they got $13.50. So a little bit, you know, on the high side, which is good for them. But later in the week, they pretty much took a dive.
Let me say something. If I had a sound machine right now, and you said the word Boingo again, I would do a Bronx cheer.
Boingo?
Yeah.
You like that?
No. I'm done with the whole... I think the whole stock idea is stupid. Maybe I'll be proved wrong. This thing is going to rock it up. But I don't get it. No, seriously. I'm not saying it from a...
Could be like a Vonage, right?
Are they still even around?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They got good commercials, but they don't sell anything.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. So... let's kind of step back for a second and look at a bigger picture for a moment. Let's talk about the whole adage, sell in May and go away.
Ah, yes.
Now, that doesn't always work. You know, you have all these little things, you know, these kind of the January effect, the sell in May and go away and all this. You know, what's the point of that? It's all about what? Volatility and traders go on vacation, right?
Yeah, I think most of the time you come into the summer months, Parents want to spend time with their kids. Kids are out of school. You know, typically in August is where you see the most, you know, low volatility and low trading and all that kind of stuff. And that's basically because Europe takes the whole month off.
Well, let me tell you something. What the problem with August is? Let me tell you something. I know you've heard me say some strange things out there, gang. Let me tell you what my problem with August is. I believe that August is the month, the general month, that most psychiatrists and psychologists take off.
Hmm.
Have you heard that?
No, I haven't.
It scares the hell out of me.
I can't.
That means there's people that may need their services that aren't getting them for a whole month. You know what I'm saying? I'm serious. You never thought of that?
No, never.
It's just my twisted mind. Anyway, so the bottom line is that, no, seriously, so August is one of the lightest months, although volume has been pretty pathetic. Really has been pretty pathetic lately on average. Although, you know, if you've been listening to all the people that have been talking about, oh, volume's bad. You know, I look back a number of years to see what volume is. Volume's not that bad.
Well, I mean, we're talking about when you're looking to compare it against some of the volume that we had in 2008 and 2009. I mean, those were record high volumes.
Right.
Actually, I read a recent article, and I can't remember the source, but they were talking about high frequency trading is really starting to come down quite a bit because the volume is just not there for them to do so.
Right. I sent you that story last night from Bloomberg.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. Seriously.
I thought I saw it on something else too.
Yeah, I sent it to you. Yeah. That was a good article.
No,
right?
When high frequency trading starts to dry up, you know, there may be some room for, you know, some actual buying and selling, you know, by the individual trader.
But not only high frequency trading, what happens if supposedly they're like 70% of the market, you know, they've always complained that they keep the market up.
Right.
What happens? Do we see another flash crash? I know it's May.
Well, but I think a lot of the flash crash had the problem is that the high frequency trading started it and then they just
They turn the machines off.
Right, exactly.
So I don't know what the difference is right now.
Well, I mean, I think the difference is that, you know, if you start to, it's kind of like being on that, you know, that smoking high or that nicotine patch, you know, you kind of,
I don't know about that.
You pull it off nice and, you know, slowly.
Yeah.
You wean it off.
Yeah.
So then high frequency trading, if it's, you know, if they slowly come out of the market, then there won't be such a huge impact.
Right.
But if they release it instantaneously, like they're in the flash crash, that's a big problem.
So if you, like, eat that patch.
Oh, yeah. That's a problem.
That's a problem, probably. Yeah. Mm. Is that have nicotine in it? Is that what that is?
I think so, yeah. Ugh, just go to poison control then.
So when you look at the sell in May and go away and the sum of volatility which comes down, is this an opportunity to look for like selling the VIX, or is this there's no rhyme or reason?
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of mulled this over quite a bit for some time, and are we in a different time now where, you know, you have low interest rates and all the different things? I mean,
implicit guarantees.
Yeah, I mean, I keep wanting to say that, you know, we're in different times. You know, it's this summer is not going to be any different than the other summers. But I truly believe that, you know, there may still typically be some volatility here because we're at all-time highs here pretty much on some of these indices, which is, you know, absolutely amazing. But we've seen some of the European indices and some of the foreign markets drop down quite a bit. And it'd be interesting to see that over the summertime here, if you can get the U.S. markets to come down a little bit on that.
So if we sell a man and go away, do we get to go somewhere or still have to work?
We should take a vacation.
We should.
Right. We could podcast it from wherever.
Oh, that's right. I got that mobile one that I do with Dvorak.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Next week on the Queen Elizabeth.
Ah, very nice.
So the discussion, though, is when it comes to what's going on right now, you know, the VIX last week clipped and closed over its 50-day average, which it hasn't done for a while.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a big deal because it's only like 17 and change.
Right.
But it was down by 14.
Yeah, it's been almost scary how low the volatility index has been.
And the problem has been that we actually did a couple of VIX options and we made some money on some, but then, you know, you can go for a little while where just there's, you know, creeping up or down and the VIX just doesn't go, not only doesn't go anywhere, it goes down 6-7% a day.
Right.
And then, you know, you have an option that's essentially just gets crushed on a daily basis. So, you know, when you look at the VIX and the opportunity there, we don't like those ETFs. The ETFs don't work.
They work. It's just, you know, it's one of those things where you have that compounding effect, which is very difficult to factor in. Your timing has to be... for me, it seems like your timing has to be almost perfect.
Well, because you need a consecutive move day by day by day in the direction.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Otherwise, it gets floppy.
It's one of those things where Okay, yeah. Back in 2009, we saw the volatility index hit up to like 80 or something like that. But its natural progression is to come down. I mean, the VIX can only stay up for so long. Otherwise, you know, you got some really serious issues. But, you know, and that's the problem with these ETFs is it's generally just going to slope down over a slow period of time. But if you can catch it at the right time, then it's going to pop up. And that's why we like to use the options a little better, because it's a little more control. You know, you have an expiration date, which, you know, is good or bad in some situations. But
yeah, but the problem is right now that I'm finding with the options, for example, is if you have a fully loaded portfolio with equities long, let's say, just, you know, generally speaking,
right,
the volatility on those is really pretty wide. And so on the downside. Okay, let's
say, right?
So now you have the VIX that covers you. How much you buy? 1-2%? You buy a 2% position of a VIX. That means you got to get a 2% or better return on your total portfolio over a period of time just to make up for the VIX cost.
Right.
Right? So now you have...
That's if you're saying if it deteriorates, right?
Yeah, if it deteriorates, if things just go up and kind of just slope up and do its thing, right? Or,
right.
You know, generally. So, okay, that's possible. But on the downside, it doesn't necessarily protect you for the whole portfolio.
Well, but you're talking about... Okay, so over a long period of time, having a 2% rise, even in like 2 months, that's been pretty, that's happened quite a bit over these last couple of months.
I agree.
So, I mean, you put that VIX option on, you could probably get anywhere from 2-4%, but, you know, you're also protecting yourself on the downside. We've seen some of these options move up 100%.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's...
we had one of them moved up 100% in, what, 3 days?
Right, exactly.
Ridiculous. Yep. I mean, and that was way out of the money, by the way.
Right.
Way out of the money. You know, you thought it would move, but not that much. But then we've seen them move down 20-30% a day,
yeah,
too.
I mean, buying the VIX options has been very difficult lately, just in the fact that, you know, volatility has stayed at unprecedented levels on the low side, that's for sure.
So also, let's kind of move over for a moment into the discussion of some of the notable stocks that recently we've been talking about, some great earnings, like Whole Foods. I mean, wow.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
I think there was a lot of people not expecting that they would actually have such a great quarter.
Yeah, especially with the high cost of food prices. You know, wheat, corn, soy, all that stuff.
Yeah, April was a high again from the UN put out their recent piece, and it was at a high again. And that was pretty good. Ancestry.com, I mean, just blew out numbers. I mean, the stock went just vertical.
Right.
And it was pretty amazing. I think it was up 40% in a day or something like that.
Yep.
But what was really cool about Ancestry.com, if you don't know if you know this, but there's a show on TV called Who Am I? Who Are You? Where Are You From? Where Am I From?
Right, with the celebrities, right?
Yeah. That's sponsored, I think, paid for by Ancestry.com, so they could do in the commercials the whole time.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, it's one of those things where you watch those commercials and it makes you think, hey, maybe I got something cool in my background.
Right, maybe.
It's like that one guy said, I never knew my parents lived next to the Wright brothers.
Right.
That would have been something good to know.
Yeah, my question would be, maybe they're not my parents. Maybe I can find something that proves this.
That's right.
No, Barry and Anita, I'm sorry. Just kidding out there, gang. When you look at how they made their money, one of the things was that you get name recognition from this kind of advertising. So you're looking at companies like, you know, a Tempur-Pedic, that who's buying mattresses? Who's buying, you know, $5,000 mattresses? Well, you know, how do you know? Well, you know about it. It's every other minute on TV.
Yeah, see, that's very interesting you bring that up, because I see a big difference here between like an Ancestry and a Tempur-Pedic. Tempur-Pedic, you actually have to go out and buy the thing.
Right.
Whereas like Ancestry, it's amazing. You just go online, they take your credit card information, and zip, zam, you're done.
Right. Well, that's like Citrix GoToMeeting, for example. And one of the things about the GoToMeeting is they do the same thing. They run commercials all over the place.
And
so I think that, and this is not earth-shattering news or any information that you don't know already, but it's the name familiarity that's really been helping a lot of companies, like the Netflixes of the world, even when they don't have good earnings, or a Chipotle, or you look at with Green Mountain Coffee recently. You know, they came out with numbers. This company, by the way, they're evil. So they come out with the first thing on the earnings report is that they're going to do a 7 million share offering, which usually is dilutive, right? And it causes the stock to go down.
Usually, yes.
Usually, nope. Did I not say this to you? Did I not say this? As soon as that came out, I said, you wait for this. They halt the stock. It opens up 30 minutes later, 20% higher when they blow out earnings. And I said, Kevin, I'm telling you, they're gonna screw the shorts here.
That's right.
They love screwing the shorts.
Oh, people love their coffee, man.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they love the coffee. The Starbucks has done well. The coffee prices are at an all-time high.
Yeah, which is unbelievable considering the input prices on these coffee makers. I mean, they have to be getting strapped.
Right.
I mean, I know... the CEO of Green Mountain came on and said they were going to raise prices by 10%, but you know, is that enough? I mean, you're talking about a huge move in some of their coffee prices. Maybe they've hedged out a little bit. Maybe they have their own farms. I'm not sure, but, you know, that's something to look into, especially with, you know, the Starbucks, the Green Mountains. And
So here's my theory on that, by the way. I think that there's going to be a very interesting potential move. You know, one of the things that Bernanke said is that inflation is transitory.
Right.
And I always thought, how did he know that? How does he know that it's only going to be? I think we got the answer is that he knows that because he's got it with the inflation button.
That's right. He's going to control it.
Right. So whether or not he whispered in the guy here at CME for the silver, or whether or not the CME guy heard Obama talking about how there's a lot of speculation in these commodity markets, particularly oil, and they put the clamp on it, and you know, in response to that, and say, you know, to show the power, because there's a lot of power plays going on lately.
Oh yeah,
if you haven't noticed, and I think there's a lot of posturing more than ever because of the lot of things that are going to be going on in the administration and Congress, and a lot of votes and a lot of repeal potential. But I think that when you consider the fact that a lot of companies, for example, like an Albemarle, a chemical company, an Eastman Chemical, these guys raised their prices over the last several like a year or so, and their numbers have been outstanding, their EPS numbers and all that. Now you look at potentially companies that are going to be raising their prices. And if, in fact, the commodity or input goes down in price, if,
right,
and they've already figured and estimated, budgeted, and forecast for a higher priced input, I mean, that could be the next wave that generates a substantial amount of earnings momentum.
Right.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah, for sure.
So if Bernanke is right about this, or said a different way, if Bernanke could really pull this trick off by pushing that button and taking inflation down.
Yeah, because you're saying basically that the company has already projected for the commodity price to be elevated to a certain level, and then now you have it at a much cheaper price, and you're selling, your margins are actually much greater than,
right,
is what you're saying,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's kind of cool. Listen, I've been on a couple conference calls this week, and the margins have been just tremendous. Two of the one in particular I'll just mention is you had Acme Packet, which they do the session board controllers for things like video conferencing and teleconferencing and a variety of other things. Very, very neat company. They were very upbeat. They were projecting higher. Stock got all kind of wacky after hours and then moved up nicely. But Acme Packet, I got to tell you something, it was a really interesting call because you could see where the future is going and the necessity of keeping a or of building out the infrastructure is quite remarkable. In terms of telecommunications, et cetera. We've owned it. We're out of it. We're probably going to go back into it, to be honest with you. It's just a stunning, stunning opportunity. But the other one that's interesting was Atmel. Atmel once again showed me, along with, let's say, for example, what we saw from Apple. Atmel is just amazing at the amount of – they make the touchscreens and the sensors and the
microphones. Yeah, I think a lot of their the companies they work with are like the HTCs, yep. Samsung. Right. I don't think they necessarily are working with Apple.
No, they're not working with Apple.
Right? Yeah. No.
They have the Android systems. They have the
right.
The they have the
which
Motorola.
Is a gigantic market.
Yeah.
Oh my god,
Microsoft. So what's interesting is that the amazing demand for a lot of different reasons. The first reason is that you just have demand. The second reason is that what's happening is they're getting an amazing amount of inquiries from all over the world that was using manufacturing and supply from Japan. Now, one of the things that you heard on the call was, first of all, what you're hearing a lot of calls, what is the significance of the Japanese situation on your production, manufacturing? Well, Atmel doesn't have any manufacturing or anything in Japan. But what they're finding is that they're getting a lot of inquiries for product, and a lot of companies that can't get the supply are looking to find alternatives, which is good for some of these companies. You could find companies that don't have anything that went wrong and that are can be used as an alternative. They may have some real interesting profit potential.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you're seeing all kinds of supply disruptions happening in Japan, and if anybody's going to profit from that, you know, it's going to be U.S. companies. Just as weak as our dollar's been, you know, it's much cheaper to order parts from us than it is from from Japan, especially when there's supply disruptions. I mean, Japan has really had some problems with this quake and the tsunami, but you know, fortunately, you know, they're going to be able to rebuild, and you know, it's going to be a plus for them, I think.
Right. So one of the discussions that you and I have been having, and we wrote about in our recent commentary, was about the yen. The yen is, by all measures, terribly overvalued.
Oh, yes. The yen, it's the strongest it's almost ever been.
Yeah, besides that one day that it dipped down to 76. You know, historically, over 20 years or so, it was as high as 300.
Yep.
And it came down to 75, which 76, which is the reason why they're in a deflationary spiral. I mean, the goods that you buy for them are so much more expensive because the yen's all out of whack.
Right, exactly.
So that's number one. This, you know, and you have to look at what's going on there, and there needs to be intervention because it started to move higher again last week.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and they're one of the biggest, they have one of the biggest trade surpluses, which basically means, you know, they're going on the Walmart model, let's say. You know, they're selling things in bulk.
Right.
They're trying to do the best they can by shipping as many goods as possible. Whether or not they're getting a good margin on that product, probably not, just because their yen is so overvalued.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about anything you sell to the U.S., they're basically taking a haircut on. So, you know, one of the things that's come up is that, you know, some of these supply disruptions may offset some of their trade surplus, which is going to be big for the currency trade of the dollar yen. So, anytime,
does that benefit the yen? It weakens the yen.
Yes, it should weaken the yen. Right. And any kind of disruption on the trade surplus should weaken the yen, which is, you know, it's kind of been their strong suit for some time now. So.
So the point is that it is overvalued. We're actually playing it from the short side.
Yeah.
That we think that the yen will actually, over time, move down in value.
Yeah, it we're shorting sense. The yen against the dollar.
Yeah,
right.
And it makes sense for us, by the way, as in the U.S., to do what we can to weaken them because it benefits us. It makes their products cheaper for us.
Right, exactly.
I mean, so I
no, you know, no, no, no. Well, yeah, yes, yeah. Right, yeah, you're correct.
Well,
yes,
if our dollar goes up, it makes their products cheaper.
Exactly.
So, I mean, there's all this that's going on, and I think it's kind of interesting in that we're seeing this dynamic, this rush for safety, but they don't want to be in the dollar. I mean, we've seen report after report that is saying that, number one, China's not buying as much bonds from us, that central banks want to diversify against away from the dollar, so they're buying gold. Mexico bought some ridiculous amount of gold.
Yeah,
I didn't know there was so much gold in the world.
People don't want to be in the U.S. dollar because we have no policy of a strong dollar. Well, I'm sorry. We have a strong policy against for the dollar.
Yeah.
Geithner and Bernanke have came out and said that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But we're not, you know, we are having problems with debt.
We're having problems tying our shoes in Congress, for God's sakes.
That's right. There's no problem. I mean, we're having discussions about a debt ceiling when, you know, should we really even be having those discussions rather than just trying to figure out how to fix the debt?
Right. But let me just get back to something. I want to talk about technology for a second. It is very clear to me. We own Apple, by the way, but this is not why I'm talking about this. It's very clear to me from the discussions we saw from Microsoft, Research in Motion, even the Atmel, and from HTC in their operation. And Apple is eating their lunch.
Yeah, they just—it's almost like they have a far superior product.
It's either far superior. It's again back to user functionality. It's back to user knowledge of the product. You know, they have it and all that, and obviously the cool factor, of course.
Right.
But it is amazing that the trail of dust they're leaving behind them.
Oh yeah.
Research in Motion's earnings came out. This is ugly. Microsoft's talking about the tablet and the compression of their earnings due to that. HTC had a really bad quarter. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that thing about the tablet. Is, you know, RIM has been pushing this tablet for I don't know how many months now. It seems like almost a year to me that they've been coming out with this playbook, and you still can't even get your hands on one.
No such thing.
No. I mean,
it's a carrot.
Is it?
Yeah.
It sure seems like it.
They haven't made it yet. They just have. They took a cereal box, cut it out, and painted it, and they showed it on TV a lot. That's it.
Yeah.
Because it's only. By the way, it's only a 7-inch. It's only 7 inches. It's pretty small.
How big is the iPad?
I think it's 9.
9? Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot smaller.
Yeah, it is.
And not to mention all the other problems you have. And they're talking about, I don't know. The big announcement last week was that Microsoft was going to put Bing on the Research in Motion OS.
Right. Oh, it's going to be the default browser.
I mean, like, woohoo! That's going to be a big one.
Yep.
I'm sure that really raised up the value of Microsoft shares. I mean,
Google's really shaking.
Yeah, well, oh man, you see that stock go down? Gap down on that news. Gapped. the other thing is, you know, you talk about what could fuel the rally, what could fuel the failure. Clearly, that the failure could be fueled by, I think, the a government policy. It could be fueled by, you know, our inability to meet earnings. It could be fueled by improper Fed policy, et cetera. I think that the earnings we want to focus on here for a second and talk about earnings and merger and acquisition. Again, Merger Monday is like every Monday. This week we saw what? We saw AMAT, Applied Materials.
Yeah. AMAT bought Variant Semi for 50% premium, which is absolutely amazing.
Amazing.
I mean, it just seems like right now companies are just looking to leverage and to synergize as much as they can because, you know what? They're not going to be able to grow unless they have some new product or some better way of automating things or creating things because, you know what, they already laid off all these workers. So they don't have anybody hands-on to create things or do anything. All they want to do is utilize the free money that the government is giving them in order to merge with other companies and create synergies. So and companies have done really well at this. Companies have really done well at getting their earnings to a respectable level, despite the fact that the economy is not as profitable as what it's been in the past.
But I think the big fallacy there is that when we talk about the economy all the time, we're always focused on the U.S., right?
Right.
And the reality is that these days, it's not just the U.S. I mean, this is obvious, but you know, a company these days doesn't just do business here; they do business worldwide. And really, a lot of the world is emerging. Hello. You know, a lot of the world is there's billions of people that are actually embracing many of the things that we have. So when we look at the economy, I think a lot of errors are done in judging the strength of the U.S. economy based just on the U.S. economy.
Right.
Whereas the U.S. economy is really based on the world economy and vice versa.
Right. I mean, and that's a great point you make up there because you have a lot of multinationals that are selling quite a few of their goods over to foreign nations because – you know what? The dollar is cheap. Anybody in Europe or Japan or whatever that is interested in American good is basically buying it like a 20% discount.
Right.
So that's why, you know, I think that's why, you know, you're seeing a lot of strength in the Dow. I mean, it's been amazing. The Dow has
very, very relatively strong, unbelievable.
Yeah, it's been very strong against the NASDAQ, the Russell. I mean, the Russell has come down, gosh, it must be somewhere between 5 and 7% last week. Whereas the Dow seemed to, you know, hold up quite well.
Well, one of the things is the Dow, don't forget, is made up of these industrials and the multinationals, and I think they've been getting a tremendous boost from the weak dollar. And when they actually came down was when the dollar strengthened.
Right, exactly.
They came down hard. As a matter of fact, they led
the
decline on that at that point.
Yeah, we're talking about companies like McDonald's, Caterpillar, Procter & Gamble, all these big multinationals.
Because there was no news. It was just that the dollar moved. That was
right.
It. Yep. Really, that's all that happened, and that's what that moved that whole deal. So, you know, there's a lot of I guess things that we need to be aware of in terms of, you know, how the dollar. The problem, you know, the old days, you didn't have to worry about these things, you know, as much. You didn't have to worry about currency moves as much because there wasn't as much currencies moving. You know,
right.
A 2% currency move 15 years ago, I'd be under my desk.
Well, there also wasn't this whole issue of globalization.
Right.
I mean, you're really talking about moving product. I mean, back 15 years ago, I don't even know if there was the logistics in order to get goods over there that fast and that quickly.
No, there wasn't. There was shipping.
Especially efficiently.
Right.
You know?
No, there wasn't. And you know, right now you could order something from China and you can get it 2 days later, one day later, for that matter. I guess the last thing is really the idea that when we look at the outlook right now, you know, there's clearly been distribution in these markets. There's no question about that. You know, we still see that, you know, just for the time being, I mean, you know, a little sell-off here, a little sell-off there. I mean, there's still a lot of stocks. It's amazing, actually, last week that there was a grouping of the growth stocks that were just obliterated. I mean, just 10, 15% in a week.
Right.
And there's one, I think it was Wednesday or Tuesday, that was really a bad day. But we were looking at, like, well, it's not everything. It's not broad-based this time. Usually you see everything. Everything's red.
Yeah.
It was kind of like hit or miss on what was red and what was green this time.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, with this drop.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've definitely seen that sector rotation.
Yeah, it's been there. I mean, it's clearly been. We saw that rotation on the last 12 weeks, something from you know, to the staples from the others. Anyway, listen, we'll save some of that because we have some good things. We'll actually put some of that maybe on the disciplineinvestor.com, that really cool sector rotation chart that you have. I want to remind everybody before we say goodbye to Kevin that of course we have Andrew Ross Sorkin from the New York Times going to be here. Very shortly with Jack Swagger, that is the famous Jack Swagger, Market Wizards, and John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is going to be back by popular demand. Lots more coming. We have, of course, make sure to go over to thedisciplineinvestor.com and check out all the things we have there. We write a lot about economic stocks, all sorts of things going on over there. And Kevin Hoffman.
Thank you.
Always good to have you, buddy.
Yeah, it's great.
It's great. Great guy, and you get a lot. I know we're going to get a lot of email. How they get that guy Kevin back on here? And for all of you out there, thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. If you enjoy what you hear, do me a favor, send a link to a friend. Tell them to check it out on iTunes. And of course, we have the other podcasts you can listen to at DH Unplugged or over at The Winning Investor. We'll give you little tidbits on how to invest in kind of 5 minutes or under. Little ideas and things to think about, maybe some ways to kind of brush up on what you're doing. Until next time, thanks for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz. We'll see you real soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.